So this is on class three of four classes on the Ashtavaka Gita. As you probably have figured out, this is an amazing text, full on. I mean, you know, there's really, I can't think of personally any text like this in world spiritual literature. It is an extended kind of treatment on what it would mean to be free. And you don't really find that. You find a lot of course, in religious literature, you find a lot of you should do this and you should do that, and you know, you should practice this and you practice that. There's very few extended treatments where they say just don't do nothing. Just relax already, you know, for 20 chapters, just relax already. And that's an amazing thing. That's an amazing thing to hear. It's an amazing thing to, you know, to have the karma, or whatever you want to call it, to even hear a text like this. And many, many people haven't heard a text like this. Many people don't know about this text. And so we're very lucky to have the opportunity to study it, and to have our egos be attacked, you know, kind of systematically, at, you know, from every direction, you know, which is the point of the text, really, is to just kick out every prop that we think that we have to stand on. Because all of these props are keeping us from freedom. You know, we can't be free if we are attached. And so it just goes through the whole kind of laundry list. Let me count the ways in which we are attached. We are attached to, you know, first and foremost, to our individual self, to our individuality, to our personality, to our particularity. We are attached to being separate from other beings, from life itself. We're attached to that separateness, and we suffer from it. Which is, it doesn't mean, by the way, I mean, I wanted to throw this in because Cindy was kind of mentioning it. It doesn't, you know, the somebody self. We will always be somebody. You know, unless like after death you just like become permanently nobody. But, you know, if there's rebirth and or whatever, you know, life after death, we'll always be somebody. You know, you'll be somebody as you move into awakening. You'll still be somebody. You'll still have a personality, still have a particular body, you know, some particular color eyes, particular preferences maybe. But you won't take yourself so seriously. And so we can practice as somebodies, you know, practice lightening up on our way to enlightenment, and not take ourselves so seriously, not take life so seriously either. You know, life is a transient passing thing, and then we get all attached to one event or another or something like that, and like try to freeze frame it, and then try to magnify it into like something huge. And it's just passing. This too shall pass. Which is really good to remember when things are going bad. Right? This too shall pass. People commit suicide because they don't believe that this too shall pass. You know, they get into a rut and then they think this is going to be the way it is for the rest of my life, and I'd rather not live, you know, in this horror. And it's just ignorance. It's just an ignorant thing because everything's changing all the time. Everything's changing. And the more we can embrace change, the more we will be free. The more that we can embrace the fact that everything, without exception, that you can think of is changing. And then some of the Buddha heads raise their hand and say, no, empty space isn't changing. Well, who the hell cares? Everything else is changing. So if you investigate change, you know, if you go deep, if you explore deeply what change is, you get to emptiness rather quickly. What they call emptiness. Because, you know, to have change at all, there has to be something that changes. Right? Change isn't happening without something that changes. But if change is happening at the rate, inconceivable rate, that change must be happening at, there can't be something changing either. So there can't be a process of change without something changing. But there can't be something that's changing, you know, three quadrillion, is that a number? Quadrillion times a second. You see? So, you know, change is worth thinking about. If everything's changing, then what is everything? And who am I also, you know, if I'm changing? Anyway, We got a lot to do tonight, so I can't just ramble. So the question, the text begins with a question, as do many of the ancient Sanskritic Indian texts. And the question that all these texts ask, you know, to begin, the student asks the teacher a question, really. And the question's pretty much always the same. It's phrased differently, but it's pretty much always the same. How should I live? How should I live? What should I do with life? You know? And Janaka asks this question of Ashravaka, you know, in a kind of a particular way. How can I be wise? How can I have jnana? J-N-A-N-A. How can I live wisely? How can I wise up about life? And jnana is quite different from facts and figures and data. Okay, it's not knowledge. Wisdom is not knowledge. How can I live? So it's not easy. How can I be really smart? That's not what he's asking. But how can I live wisely? So I know what's what in life. Then he says, and how can I live freely? Mukti, how can I live freely without all of the attachments and compulsions and obsessions that we are driven by? How can I live freely? And then how can I live with vairagya, with detachment? That's usually the translation for it, but as I have mentioned the last couple of nights, imperturbability is my preference at this point for vairagya. Dispassion, literally, it means in Sanskrit. Dispassion. Dispassionate. Which doesn't mean that you just don't care about anything. Apathy or something like that. That's not what vairagya means. But it does mean that you don't take things so seriously. It does mean that you go with the flow, you know, and not get stuck. Not get like hooked by the, you know, by the fish hooks of life, you know. And so it's another way really of talking about how to live freely. How to live freely with change, without getting involved, overly involved in one or another of the constantly changing events of life. So he pops the question, and then Ashtarvaka tells him, you know, think about who you really are. Think, are you really just the somebody self that you think you are? First of all, what would that be exactly? You know, who are you? Even in that individualized sense, are you your job? Are you your profession? Are you your age group? Are you your body? You know, who do you think you are exactly? Which is a damn good question to ask. You know, really good question. You know, and it's not an easy one to answer. It's been asked for millennia in religion and philosophy and stuff like that. The question of personal identity is very, very thorny. Very, very difficult to figure out who I am. So we don't ask that question because we don't want to get confused, you know, by the fact that the answer is not so apparent. So we don't ask the question at all. And that's ignorance. You know, that's kind of the essence of ignorance, is not asking questions. And just like sort of assuming that, of course, I know who I am, you know, without ever exploring it. So I've been on this book tour for a while, you know, way too long, actually. And in order to get people's attention sometimes, I say, I'm very glad that my book isn't categorized self-improvement or self-help, because almost all the books on self-improvement are wrong. And there are plenty of books on self-improvement, you know. Like, if you go to Amazon.com, you'll pull up tens and thousands of titles on how to improve yourself, how to help yourself. But they're all wrong because they assume that we know who we're talking about when we're talking about ourselves. How can you improve a self that you don't know? You see, just assume it, and, you know, don't think about it, and then how can you improve a self like that? So who are you exactly? And that's what Ashtavaka challenges Janaka to think about. Are you who you think you are? Are you your mental afflictions? That would be a good kind of possibility, actually, if you wanted to try to define the individual self, a bundle of mental afflictions. You are nothing more than a bundle of mental afflictions. And you could argue that. You could argue that case pretty strongly, I think. That we are nothing other than our unhappiness. We are nothing other than our discontentment. And then we hold on to it as if it were some kind of badge of honor. to be somebody who's constantly unhappy. And so, you know, so who are you exactly? And then he says it kind of positively. You are, in addition to being somebody, you are also nobody. When you stop holding on to somebody, you become nobody. And that is your deeper nature. So you always be somebody. But who are you in between being somebody? You know? We have to maintain the somebody self. You know, because it can't float on its own. Because it's not there. It has to be maintained by conceptualization. It has to be maintained by thought. We have to maintain it by keeping a self-conception going. But when we drop the self-conception, you could say dropping the self, the self-centeredness, the self-awareness. When we drop that, who are we then? Who are you then? And then he points in a positive way to your vastness, to your cosmic nature, to your deeper true nature. When you drop the somebody self, you are nobody and therefore everybody and everything. And that's when we're happiest. That's when we're in bliss. He says, you are bliss in the first chapter. That's who you really are. You are really bliss. And so, you know, we have this kind of fear. We all have this kind of fear. We have, you can call it the fear of freedom. Liberphobia, if you want, like a really fancy word for it. Liberphobia. We are afraid of being free. Because if we're free, we're not ourselves. We're not the somebody self that we think we are. Or at least we don't take that somebody self so damn seriously. You know, to be free means to be free of individuality. Okay? It's not the freedom, it's not the freedom for the individual. It's the freedom from the individual. From having to carry around the burden of being somebody all the time. And it's very interesting to like just reflect on the fact that we are actually happiest when we drop it. When we don't sustain the self-conception, when we let it drop and rest and relax into our true nature. So then the second chapter, you know, begins with the famous Sanskrit particle. I don't know what you call it. It's a particle, I guess. Aho. Aho. So Janaki hears, you know, just a few words from his teacher and then aho. I get it. You could translate it like that. I get it. Or maybe wow. You know, you could translate, you know, many, many different English sort of equivalents. And he awakens. Aho, bodhamma aham. I am awake. I am awakened now. And then the rest of the text is just about this dialogue between two awakened beings, actually. Of, you know, what they think, how they are. And the chapters are divided, Ashtavaka said, and then Janaka said, but it's all the same at this point. After the first chapter, it's all the same. It's just one being speaking in two voices. You know, one awakened being. And all awakened beings are awakened in the same way. Okay? The awakened state is not a particular state. It's not an individualized state. It's a universal state. So then people get it all mixed up. You know, there's so many ways that we can screw up religion. So then people say, no, there's a difference. There's this white deity, white Tara, and she's white. And then there's green Tara. She's green. See, they're different. And it's just like, come on, it's just pictures. It's just pictures. They're not different. Enlightened beings are all the same. They may appear differently, right? They may appear as different somebodies. Well, every somebody is different than every other somebody. But the awakened state, Buddhahood, if you want to call it that, is all the same. It is a universal state of mind. It's a cosmic state of mind. It's not differentiated. It's not particularized or individualized. So we're afraid of freedom and we're afraid of losing our individuality. But we can't be free until we lose our individuality. Until we stop grasping to the somebody self as if it were the only self that existed. It's a role that we're playing. It's a wave in the ocean. But we are not the wave. We are the wave, but we're not only the wave. Right? And even the wave is just the ocean in motion. Don't forget. Right? The wave is not different from the ocean. The wave is just the ocean taking a form, taking a shape. And it, the wave arises and lasts for a while and goes back to the ocean. And you are the ocean, says Ashtavaka to Janaka. And Janaka says, aho, I get it now. And then the famous mantra, right? Aho aham namo mahyam. I am so awesome. Aho aham, I am unbelievable. Namo mahyam, I bow down to me. Mahyam is the first person pronoun in the dative case. To me, I bow down to myself. And don't forget, who is the I he's bowing down to? Is it the little I? Is it the individual I? Is it the ego? And of course it's not. He's bowing down to his true nature, to who he really is. And that is the guru to bow down to. Is the guru inside of you. The guru who is the one universal guru. And we all have that inside of us. We are all that. Okay? So he also says in the second chapter, something I wanted to kind of pick up again. He says, the root of suffering is dualism. The root of suffering is dvaita, dualism. And so this is a text on advaita, on non-dualism, on recognizing the unity of things. And yesterday or the day before, I can't remember, yesterday I guess, we talked about one possibility of the many, actually, that you could identify as what they mean by non-dual. There is a subject, an object, and a relationship between the subject and object. Seer, visible object, and seeing. All like that, right? The three spheres. And no one of them can come first. They all have to occur together. In fact, Nagarjuna argues also, they can't appear simultaneously either. Because the simultaneous appearance of three things would seem to indicate three different things that appear simultaneously. Three different things that appear simultaneously. So they can't appear sequentially. One can't exist before the other, nor can they exist simultaneously, because that would mean three things that pop up at once. They exist only interdependently, which is kind of hard to grasp, you could say. Hard to grasp. You know, you get to this level of of reality, of exploring how reality works, and oftentimes authors will say it's achintya. You know, you can't think it. You can't even think it. So we can't think of something, of subject, object, and relationship between them, apart from thinking of them sequentially or simultaneously. Right? We can't even, imagine it. We can't even get it. So that's why wisdom is there. Wisdom isn't knowledge. So what we're doing here is knowledge, right? We're trying to smarten up a little bit, you know. And many of these texts, this one included, are trying to undermine our confidence in knowledge. Undermine our confidence in being able to think our way into awakening. And trying to loosen the grasp that we have on the intellect, which is a very strong grasp. Especially for overeducated people like all of us. So actually it's a very, very good text for us. Because we are overeducated. This is a text on wisdom. It's not a text on bhakti, for example. It's not a text on devotion. Devotion, is another way of not thinking. To give it up to the heart. But this one is saying, let's try to explode your brain. Let's see what happens then. See what you're left with then. You see? Who would you be without conceptual thought? So I was thinking this afternoon, I'll just try this out. I haven't tried it out before. Especially before Michael Johnson, so I'm a little wary. But I'm going to claim tonight, Michael, that religion and science have the same goal. They have exactly the same goal. That the goal of both of these enterprises is to realize reality. To get to reality. Right? To recognize and realize what's truly real. And religion has that, you know, in its higher forms. Of course, there's many lower forms of religion that are all about, you know, stories and mythologies and comics and supernatural stuff and all of that. But the higher forms of religion are, let's try and find out tattva, what is, you know, what really is. And like science, both science and religion, I'll get corrected on this later if Michael doesn't like it. Both science and religion mostly fail at that because they both depend on conceptualization. Most forms of religion, you know, spin out theologies, they spin out doctrines, they spin out dogmas, trying to get at what's real. And science does too, of course. And there can't be a recognition of objective reality until the subject goes. The subject-object distinction prevents recognition of reality. Because the subject is ultimately just thinking about its own conceptualization of reality, you see. It's not getting at reality. Neither science nor religion, with their doctrines and dogmas, are getting at reality through conceptualization. When you are thinking about an object, you are thinking about a conceptualization of an object, not the object. You're thinking about an idea of the object, and that's the case in both religion and science. So, religion in its kind of, you know, usual form. So, a text like this is saying the only objective knowledge that there is non-dual. Which means that the subject and object distinction has to collapse. Non-dual. So that also means that wisdom. Wisdom is not knowledge. In other words, you can't have knowledge of objective reality. You can have wisdom about objective reality. But the wisdom comes when the subject-object distinction is gone. Which means that the subject identifies with the object. And that's kind of what this text is about. Advaita. There is no difference between inside and outside. The idea that there's a difference between the inside, what's going on in the subject mind, and the outside, what's going on out there, is an illusion. There's no difference. How can you get out of yourself, for one thing? You see, how does the subject get out of the subject mind? And have an objective view of anything, number one. See, number two, when the subject mind is thinking about the real object the subject mind is thinking about is a conceptualization of the object, not the object. And I think even the high theologians of science, the physicists, recognize this. Yeah. So non-dualistic, no difference between self and reality. No difference between me and the world. No difference between inside and outside. And the idea that there is dualism. The idea that there is a difference between inside and outside is dualism. So Advaita, non-dualism, means the recognition that it is all one, literally. It is all one. It is not two different things, inside, outside, subject and object. That they are the same thing. And I think that if you explore what the subject actually can know, all it can really know is what it calls itself. All right. The Master of Laziness. Class 3. Bondage is when the mind likes or dislikes anything, rejects or accepts anything, or rejoices or is annoyed about anything. These are, the next three verses, this verse and the next two, are definitions of bondage and liberation. So here's bondage. Bondage is when the mind has preferences. I like this, I don't like that. When it rejects something or accepts something. Where it rejoices or it is annoyed about anything. In other words, when we're forced by our mental afflictions to have, you know, to have preferences. And liberation is equanimity. Liberation is equanimity. And so again, it doesn't mean that, you know, that there aren't that you have to like eggplant or something. I'm hoping it doesn't mean that. There's a teaching in the Buddhist texts about the five Buddha families, and one of the families is Amitabha, and the evolution of the mental affliction of desire, isn't it? Desire becomes the ability to discriminate properly, which means that it doesn't mean that you don't see any differences between things. But you discriminate between the awesome things in everything. You see that there are different awesomenesses in everything, even in eggplant. Liberation is when the mind does not want or dislike, reject or accept, rejoice or is annoyed. You know, again, here he's saying liberation is kind of absolute acceptance. Absolute acceptance of everything, everything in life. Rejecting nothing, realizing that everything is necessary. There has to be bad for there to be good, there has to be ugly for there to be beautiful. So if ugly makes beautiful possible, that's beautiful. You see? There has to be pain for there to be pleasure. You know, in the world of dualistic world, you know, you recognize that one thing requires the other. One thing requires its opposite. And so both are necessary, and so both are beautiful. Both are accepted. Absolute acceptance. It is bondage when the mind attaches to any drishti, doctrine, dogma. So now he's getting at the religious folks, the philosophers and religious folks. It is bondage when the mind attaches to any doctrine or dogma. A doctrine and a dogma, a point of view, drishti literally means that, on a point of view, always separates you from others who don't have that point of view. Okay? It always requires separation. It always requires, you know, a schism of sorts to hold on to a particular philosophy, a particular religion or ism or ology, or any doctrine within those, or any philosophical point of view. And then you are automatically in argument with someone else. Automatically. So, soon to come future attractions for tomorrow's class is the last chapter of this text, where he just kind of goes through all of the, you know, doctrines that, you know, was in India in his time, more or less. And he says, well, who cares about all that? You know, one verse after that, what do I care if you say this rather than that? What do I say if you say there's an Atman rather than an Anatman? I'm free. I'm out of the discussion, you know. I'm not engaged in the debate anymore. See? Who cares? These are just words. These are just fingers pointing at the moon, you know. And then people have the finger wars and, you know, and get their knickers in a twist about words. When all that they're doing is trying to point to an experience that is beyond words. And people forget that they are pointers rather than, you know, things in and of themselves. They're just pointing the way outside of language, beyond language, to experience itself. But language is an experience. Doctrines aren't experience. They're just words. They're just concepts. It is bondage when the mind attaches to any doctrine. And also, by the way, when you attach to a doctrine or a point of view, there's always judgment involved. And here's how the judgment goes. I'm right, you're wrong. That's always how judgment goes. I'm right, you're wrong. And so again, it's not to say that there isn't discernment. Discernment is the essence of wisdom itself. Being able to tell things apart. Being able to know what to give up and what to take up, for example. But that's not judgment. And so doctrine, dogmas, isms, ologies, they all involve judgment, always. So give it up. That's bondage, he said. That's bondage. And it is freedom when the mind detaches from all doctrines. There's a very good practice. I recommend it. I heard it from what's that guy's name in Virginia, the Buddhist scholar, Jeffrey Hawkinson. He said he once had a practice that he did for, you know, a couple days at a time, where he just said, I don't know. The I don't know practice. You know, how are you doing? I don't know. Is it a nice day out? I don't know. You know. Because, you know, we don't really know a lot. Much of anything, really. So it's freedom when the mind detaches from all doctrines. When there is an I... Oh, and by the way, you know, this idea also occurs in the higher teachings of the Buddhist traditionals. Nagarjuna ends his great work on the root verses of the Middle Way saying, I bow down to Gautama, the Buddha, who taught no doctrine at all, no drishtis, who taught to think beyond drishtis, you see, beyond ologies. So, you know, I love it that there's texts that have within them their own destruction. You see, don't get attached to doctrines. It means also don't get attached to Ashtavakra Gita. Don't get attached to Nagarjuna. Don't get attached to scripture. He'll say that in this class if I ever get to it. Don't be attached to scripture at all. When there is no I, there is liberation. When you can drop the ego, drop the attachment to ego. Which again, I mean, you know, we're creeping towards the end of the retreat. And this is a very advanced text, okay? This is for somebody ready to pop, you know, like Janaka was. And so for the rest of us, you know, we're going to have to go home and have some discipline and practice. And, to do something about the somebody self, to improve it, to really improve it. Not in the fake way that most self-improvements books have, tell us to improve ourselves by thinking about ourselves more. That's mostly what self-improvement means. Just think about yourselves more. And that's not real self-improvement at all. So, there's an image that they use in the Dzogchen tradition, which, you know, for those of you who know it, this is kind of a Dzogchen text. This is about, you know, taking the goal as the path, you know, and just trying to say, like, trying to pop into it and get that aho thing going. But there's a saying in the Dzogchen tradition that you simultaneously, in your practice, try to swoop down from the peak of the mountain like an eagle while you're climbing up the mountain like a hiker. So climbing up the mountain means your practice. You know, your yoga, your meditation, your watching your morality, your, you know, trying to be a better person, being a better somebody person, but at the same time swooping down, and don't forget what the Ashtavakra Gita teaches. That eventually you have to realize there was no mountain to climb at all. So climb the mountain until you get tired of climbing. Until you feel like you've climbed enough, okay? And only you will know that. Nobody else can say, okay, you've climbed enough, now you're free. You can sit down and rest. But the highest teachings, mark my words, check it out if you don't think I'm right. If you look at the highest teachings of pretty much every religious tradition, Taoism, Hinduism, Buddhism, even Christianity, the highest teaching is relax. There's nothing to do. Stop the effort already. Just stop. Just relax. And that's awesome to hear. But it falls on deaf ears if you're still thinking you've got to hike some more. So, only you know. Only you know whether you're, you know, ready to just stop. And undo, unlearn. I don't know. So you can try the I don't know mantra a little bit. Unlearning mantra. Where there is no I, there is liberation, and when there is an I, there is bondage. Taking this into consideration, simply stop accepting and rejecting anything. Just live. You see, the word simply, the way I've translated simply, is a he laya. Which means easily, at once. Just do it easily. Just let it go. Simply stop accepting and rejecting anything. Saying, I like this, I don't like that. I prefer this, I don't prefer that. I want this out of life, but I don't want this out of life. And just radically accept life as it is. And by the way, not as you conceive of it. The conceptualization's got to go too. See? So when the conceptualization goes, then you are really in touch with life as it is, actually. The conceptualization keeps us at arm's length from life, from events, from other people, from experience. It keeps us at arm's length. Because we are experiencing not experience, but conceptualization of experience. Yeah. Samsara is just made up of your karmic inclinations, vasana. So yesterday we talked a little bit about karma as memory. And vasana is certainly memory. Vasana is a Sanskrit word that means imprints. They explain it sometimes as the smell of a perfume that a woman who has left the room leaves in the room. You see that lingering odor. And that's our memories, right? They're kind of lingering odors of something that's already happened. Something that's long gone. And so he says, samsara is just made up of all of those habits that we have. Memories. And that's another very kind of profound thing to put into your pipe and smoke for a while. We experience life through our memories. Not as it is. We experience life the way we do because we have memories, habits, of experiencing life like that in the past. And so we don't live freely. We live as life goes on through our memories, through our habits. And he says, and that's samsara. That's the opposite of freedom. Freedom is the spontaneous and unpremeditated, encounter with life as it's happening. Without conceptualization, without, putting patterns on it, without putting categories on it. Oh, this is that kind of thing. Now I'm experiencing that kind of thing, you see. Happy thing, sad thing, whatever kind of, category you're putting on it. So again, non-conceptual thinking means non-categorization. Not categorizing, but just experiencing it. Raw, pure, raw life. So samsara is made up of just your categories, you could say. Just your habitual categorization. Free yourself from all of them. Free yourself from karma in the sense of memory. Which doesn't mean, I think Michael was trying to get at this and I didn't answer his question when he was saying about amnesia, I think, right? Let me see if we were asking this the other night. Is there going to be a chance for people to ask questions, Lindsay? Where's Lindsay? Okay. Oh. Okay, good. Yeah. I read once a book about Krishnamurti. You all know, heard of him. And he was one of these many teachers, actually, modern teachers, who really emphasized living in the here and now. There's Ram Dass, there's Byron Katie nowadays. There's all kinds of them who are just like all over this. Live in the present. And I read a biography that claimed that Krishnamurti lived in the present so much that he didn't recognize people he had known for, 30, 40 years when he encountered them. Completely in the present all the time. That doesn't seem like a worthwhile goal either. It sort of seems like an Oliver Sacks, kind of novel or account. The guy who mistook his wife for a hat or something. So free yourself from all of them doesn't mean that you go amnesiac, it doesn't seem. As a liberated person, as a somebody self, we have memories. That's who we are as a somebody self. The bundle of memories. Memories constitute us. But it means we don't take them so seriously. We recognize them as memories. And not as something other than memories. You see what I mean? When we are taken in by our memories, then we forget that they are just memories. When we're taken in by our habits. So when we think, I am the kind of person that doesn't like eggplant. Because I've had memories of eating eggplant. And I didn't like it. So it's not like you don't have memories of not liking eggplant in the past. But you're not ruled by them. They're just memories. Maybe this eggplant will be better. You never know. I've discovered that about kale. I ate kale in the past. I hated it. And then, you know, people like fix it up and it tastes good. You never know. They can even make kale taste good. Who knows? So we're not just like stuck in the same ruts all the time because of our memories, because of our habits. We're willing to experience life anew every morning, every minute, right? Willing to live life anew every minute and not be and not be forced by our vasanas, by our habitual imprints, our habitual patterns, to live the same kind of way over and over and over. You see? When you've renounced them, you've renounced samsara, and you can stay happily wherever you may be. Yatatata. Whatever happens, you know, wherever you are. So then we're kind of cruising through a number of chapters here. So we'll try and keep track of who's talking, you know, but it doesn't really matter because they're saying the same things at this point. So now Ashravaka says, in the 10th chapter, give up desire, kama, you know, specifically sexual desire is kama, but not only. Desire for pleasure. Give up desire, the enemy, and the pursuit of power and wealth. Give up power and wealth also. This is a phrase, power and wealth, for one Sanskrit word, artha. Artha means trying to maximize your advantage in life. There, as many of you know, there's a whole sutra called the Kama Sutra. And if you don't know it, you should probably run out and find it as soon as you can, because you'll be very interested in it. There's another text. You know, it's kind of a, you know, it's a special. It's supposed to be written by a high class prostitute, actually, an expert in the ways of love, and then there's another. So that's one kind of pursuit. Then there's another pursuit, artha. There's another text called the Artha Shastra, which is written as a kind of an ancient Indian Machiavelli prince, the prince. It's just amoral power seeking in Sanskrit. Okay? So these are the first two pursuits in life. This is a whole teaching in Hinduism. That there are actually four. But there's kama, and they say you should pursue your pleasure right up to the point that it interferes with artha, which is the next one, which means like going to work. So you can pursue kama, you know, all weekend long, but when Monday morning comes, you got to get up and go to work. Artha. Then you go, you know, to try to get ahead in the world. And then the third one is dharma. And you can pursue the other two right up to the point where it interferes with dharma, interferes with your spiritual life, with your religious life. Then sometimes they throw in a fourth one, moksha, liberation from all three of those. So give up desire, the enemy, and the pursuit of power and wealth, which always entails loss. Well, it's kind of interesting. Always entails loss. And also religion. That's how I've translated dharma. You could maybe better try to get at what he's saying here is piety. Piety. So also religion, which is the cause of the other two. And this is very interesting to think about. Why would religion or piety, the spiritual life, be the cause of kama and artha, desire and power and wealth? And this could be an ancient Indian teaching on what's called spiritual materialism. The pursuit of religion, the pursuit of spirituality, in order to get partners and make money and get power in life. And there's all kinds of versions. You don't have to be a tele-evangelist to have a version of this. Of thinking that the spiritual life is somehow designed to make your material life more comfortable. And it is not. In fact, you could say just the opposite. Au contraire. The real spiritual life is to make your material life more uncomfortable. to be more dissatisfied with just thinking that the point in life is to, you know, have lots of boyfriends and girlfriends, make a lot of money, get ahead at the job, and then get old and die. That's not the point of life. That's not the point of a spiritual life. So maybe he's pointing that out here. That it's a very interesting way of putting it. Religion is the cause of the other two. You know, this is a religious society too, by the way. 9th century India. So, you know, it wasn't like our society, which is fundamentally secular. But he's saying, you know, kind of like, you know, religion can be misused in all kinds of ways, including the use of it to just fulfill your sort of carnal desires and your in constant need for money and power. Be indifferent to everything, he says. Look upon things like friends, property, wealth, houses, wives, and gifts as being like a dream or a magic show. And he says, this is a literal translation. They last just a few days. That's literally what he says. Just a couple of days. They go by. So, you know, once again, he's saying, like, you know, recognize change. Recognize the fact that all of these things that we're holding. It's interesting that this verse comes right after the last verse. It makes me think that I'm kind of right about the spiritual materialism interpretation of the last verse. Because then he goes into, like, materialism, you know. Property, money, wealth, houses, wives, or husband, gifts. They're all just like a dream, svapna. Just like a dream, just like a magic show. They last only a couple of days, so don't get attached to them. You know, which doesn't mean that you don't engage in them. Okay? Oh, I can't have a wife because they're just going to last a couple of days. Doesn't mean that. But it means don't get attached to them and don't think that they're there forever. You know, this is different from love, of course, you know, when it comes to relationships. You know, you can love without being attached. You think it's possible? You know, we're not good at it, but it is possible to love without being attached. In fact, you could argue, you know, sort of in the vein that Michael was talking about this afternoon, that real love is made possible by non-attachment. By not thinking about what's in it for me. You know, is he or she going to make me happy? You know, I love you, make me happy. You know, that's not real love. Love is self-sacrificing. Is thinking about the other person. And therefore it's not about you, and therefore you can't really be attached to it in a way, you see, if it's not about you. Attachments are always about us, always about the somebody self. So one way to get rid of attachment is through compassion, through love, through altruism, through thinking about other people's interests and not just your own. That's a standard issue way in spiritual life of getting, you know, detached, getting unattached to the self, the ego, and its constant wants and needs. Know that wherever there is craving, tirshna, very important word in Buddhism. This is not a Buddhist text. Very important word in Buddhism. So, important word here too. Because he's defining samsara as craving. Wherever there is craving means I want something I don't have, I don't want something I do have. The opposite of contentment. The opposite of satisfaction. Wherever there is craving, there is samsara. Practice strong vairagya. Here I translated it as detachment because he's used the adjective prauda, which means strong. Practice strong detachment and be free of craving and sukhi bhava, and you will be happy. So, you know, I've been teaching this like every which way for years now, and it's just remarkable to me how much resistance there is to the teaching on contentment. And it says so right in the text, you know, all these, especially Buddhists, they really get angry about, I shouldn't be, you know, if I was content, then I wouldn't have any compassion for all suffering beings, you know. And, you know, I'm sorry, this is Buddhism. Number one, life is suffering. Number two, it is caused, and it is caused by tirshna. It is caused by always being dissatisfied. So if you want to be happy, if you want to overcome suffering, which is the goal, course, this is a goal. The goal not just in Buddhism. Goal in Hinduism, goal in yoga, the goal in any authentic religious tradition is to be happy. You can't be happy always wanting stuff. And that includes wanting the end of wanting. Okay? It includes the wanting nirvana, wanting or wanting all of these sort of like penultimate goals in a religious life. I want samatha. Did I get samatha yet? Because I want it. No. I want good karma. I want this, I want that. It's all wanting. It's just all the same wanting. You can want in religion as easily as you can want outside of religion. But wanting is the problem. And that this is just a strong word for wanting. Krishna, craving. Tanha in Pali. Sometimes they translate it as thirst. You know, just always thirsting for something else. For something. I need another Dalai Lama teaching. You know. I need another one. Wherever there is craving, there is samsara. Practice detachment, vairagya, and be free of craving and happy. It is just this craving that is the very soul of bondage. The Hindu text, okay? Full on, same thing, same teaching. Same teaching. The atmaka bandha. It is the very atman. It is the very soul of bandha, of bondage. And destroying it is what is known as liberation. In case you were wondering. Just by detaching from the world, one obtains perpetual contentment. From a detaching from the world of cravings all the time, of course, right? Tushti, muhur muhu, means like moment to moment, second to second, you'll be tushti, content. So I thought I'd throw in, since I mentioned it last night, I think, this is a teaching from the Buddhist tradition on the three kinds of craving. There is the, what's it called, craving desire, which is kind of like kama. You know, wanting pleasure all the time. Craving desire. Then there's, or it's also like raga, for those of you who know. Raga, desire, or greed. Then there's craving, what they call craving fear, which is aversion. I crave not to have things I don't like. You see? Aversion. Then there's craving for existence. Bhava, I think, probably in Sanskrit. The craving for existence, which is wanting the me to continue. Wanting the ego, wanting the individual somebody self to have more existence. Another kind, it's probably the strongest kind of craving, really. I just want to continue. And they say, as I mentioned yesterday, they say that this last one, this last kind of craving, is the one that appears in its strongest form at the time of death. It's the last kind of thing that we think about when we're dying as ordinary people. It's the last kind of thing is, I don't want to die. I want more. I want there to be me more. And then that throws us, according to the teachings on this, it throws us into another rebirth. But not as you. So, you know, Mr. Karma's kind of clever this way. Says, okay, I'll give you what you want, but not in the way you want it. You'll get another sort of individual somebody self-existence, but you won't be you. Did you think you were going to be you? You know, sometimes people hear this like teaching on rebirth, you know, which sounds a lot better than just like coming to a total end, which is kind of what materialistic culture suggests will happen to you. If you're just your body, if you're just your brain, that when you die, it's just like those old Porky Pig cartoons. That's all, folks. The big black things. And you just blip out of existence. So then people said, oh, but I've heard that there's rebirth, you know. They've imported rebirth from India. And so maybe I won't die. Maybe I'll just keep... And then they have all these fantasies of rebirth and, you know, past life regressions where everyone was always Cleopatra, you know, or somebody famous like that. And it's not like that. Nobody's ever taught that in India. You will forget everything. You will forget who you know, everything about you. The only thing that will remain, according to the teachings, you know, on this subject, I don't know for sure, The only thing that will remain are your inclinations. See, that's the vasanas. That's memory at a subconscious or unconscious level. And that's what carries on. Not conscious memory, of course. So, how did I get off on that? What was I talking about? Craving. Oh, yeah. Craving. Craving for more of me. And, you know, again, like, be careful what you want. Yeah, first of all, you won't get that, okay? That's okay. So, but why would you want that anyway? To be you forever? You know? One who knows for sure, this phrase occurs in the next couple of verses, nishayi, without a doubt. One who knows for sure that things by their nature come into being, undergo change, and then pass away, becomes imperturbable, and without mental afflictions, and easily comes to peace. So, you know, he's saying, like, you can sort of know that things change, but you gotta know for sure if you're gonna get the benefits out of understanding, the wisdom of understanding change. And so he says, without doubt. Without doubt. And that's a whole different level. You know, it's very easy for us intellectually to understand that things change. Very easy. You know, it doesn't take much. You can teach it in 5 minutes to pretty much anybody and they'll all start nodding there. Yeah, 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 things change. But we don't act like it. We don't think like it in ordinary. As soon as you stop talking about it, then, you know, back to normal. We revert back to normal. As if things didn't change on a moment-to-moment basis. So if we really explore the depths of change and get conviction that everything, without exception, except for everything is changing, including ourselves, then he says, if you get that deep enough, the conviction deep enough, that will bring you freedom too. That will bring you peace too. Because what would you have to hold on to, you see? What would you have to be attached to if you understood that there are no objects, there are no beings, there are no nouns. It's all just verb at best. You know, maybe it's not even verbs. All just process. All just change. So what would there be to hold on to? What would there be to be attached to that would keep you from being free if you really understood change? So, doubt is a big problem, actually. There's good doubt and there's bad doubt. You know, good doubt is like, okay, I heard this thing in the Ashtavaka Gita. I don't know for sure if I can believe it. I'll think about it. That's good doubt, okay? Using your head a little bit is very good doubt. But then there's all kinds of bad doubt, including, you know, most obviously, well, you know, whatever. That kind of doubt. The whatever doubt, you know. You spend like 5 days at a retreat and then, you know, whatever. Ashtavaka Gita, whatever. Go home. As if nothing happened. You don't think about it. It doesn't enter in at all. The spore didn't get in. So that's bad doubt, you know. Or the kind of doubt that keeps us from conviction. Because it's hip, kind of, to have doubt. It's hip not to have conviction nowadays. It's hip not to believe in anything, really. Right? And to just sort of skate on irony and satire, you know, and be cool. If you look at most comedy, it's mostly like that. Most comedians are just ironic. It's just, everything's a joke. I mean, well, that's kind of what a comedian does. But you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing that couldn't be made into a joke. There's nothing sacred. And that's a very, very common ailment. And the hipper and younger you are, the more susceptible you are to that ailment, I bet. The closer you live to Portland, or Brooklyn, one who knows for sure that suffering is really just in the mind. Chintaya. It's just in your mind. And nowhere else is free from it and is always happy and at peace and all discontentment just melts away. So one who knows for sure that suffering is just a choice. that we make in our minds. That it's not foisted upon us from outside of ourselves. It's just a choice that we make. And so maybe now's the time to like reiterate that, of course, does not mean that you'll never have pain again. Suffering and pain are different. Michael was talking about this too. He's got pain in his shoulders, but you don't have to suffer from it. The only reason that we suffer from it is through, once again, attachment. We're attached to not having pain. So then when we have pain, we go, oh, how could this have happened? I got pain. Well, welcome to life. There will be pain. There will be problems, you see. It's all about kind of denial of life itself that causes us so much of our problems. You know, you can only be unhappy about getting older if you thought you never were going to get older. You see, if you were attached to the idea of permanent youth or something, or permanent health or something like that. You can only be unhappy about death if you thought you were never going to die. You see? If you're attached to the permanence of the individual self, then of course you're going to be unhappy about death. And you're going to fear it. Because you think that that's who you are. That you are the body. That you are the physicality. So it all comes back to attachment also. It's all in the head. Attachments are only in the head. So then Jenica Uvacha is here for a while. This is the 12th chapter. First I became weary of too much physical action. Then, so he's kind of reflecting on his whole spiritual career here. First I became weary of too much physical action. Then of excessive speech. And finally of thinking too much. So it is now I stay within myself. This is a phrase repeated throughout the 12th chapter. Evam, eva, aham, astitaha. I stay inside myself. So first I get weary of the work of the body, of thinking that I will achieve happiness through karma, through actions. I will work my way into karma. Then of speech, you know, of always like talking and disputing and, you know, arguing and, you know, having big debates and kind of going like this, like you were a real Tibetan monk. And then I got tired of even thinking of like having the mind just go over and over these, you know, possibilities, you know, conceptual possibilities. And so I just like collapsed into myself. No longer taking pleasure in sound sights, etc., and not fixated on the self as an object of perception. In other words, not being self-conscious. When we are self-conscious, we are fixated on the self as an object of perception. So, not my mind is free of distractions and ekagraha. Ekagra. Ekagra means one-pointed. Eka, one. Agra means mountain, a peak. So one-pointed. So my mind is free of distractions and one-pointed. So it is that now I stay within myself. By the way, the word that I translated mind here is hridaya, which really means heart. My heart is free of distractions. Maybe I should have translated it that way. Understanding that meditation is the rule of practice for those for whom there are distractions due to mental projections and such. So it is that now I stay within myself. Meditation is a rule of practice for those who need it. But if you are happy, you don't need meditation. Meditation is not the goal. It is a tool. It is like all other practices, like a raft that you use to get from one shore to the next. But getting attached to meditation is another attachment. Getting attached to meditation. He hits meditation several times in this text. Like, so it must be a real possibility to get attached to meditation and to think, well, I'm a good meditator. Maybe that's all I need, is to be a good meditator. Meditation is not an end in and of itself. Meditation is practice on living life as it occurs moment to moment. But if you're sitting there in meditation all the time, you're not actually living life moment to moment. You're living meditation moment to moment. See, got to get up from the cushion. You got to arise from the cushion and then integrate samadhi. integrate with life. That's the whole point of meditation, is to learn how to break down the separation between the self-conscious self and life itself. And to integrate, samadhi, to integrate with life as it's happening moment to moment. So there's another quote that kind of gets to this same thing. It's from a different teacher. Ajahn Chah. He was a great Thai Buddhist, what do you call him? Forest monk from the last century. He taught a lot of Western Buddhist teachers like Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and all kinds of people. So this is what he has to say. Here's his like succinct advice. Don't try to become anything. Don't try to become a meditator. Don't try to become a yogi. Don't try to become a Buddhist or a Hindu or, you know, a Christian. Don't try to be anything. Do not make yourself into anything. Do not be a meditator. Do not become enlightened. When you sit, let it be. When you walk, let it be. Sounds like the Beatles or something. Grasp at nothing. Resist nothing. See, that's freedom. That's a summary of freedom. Don't try to be anything. Don't try to become anything. Just be. See, just be. Don't try to become something. That's all fueled by the ego and by wanting, by desire. I want to become a good meditator. I want to become, you know, a great yogi. Don't try to become anything, just be. When you sit, let it be. When you sit, just sit. You know? Because I'm sitting, I don't want to walk. You know, as soon as we sit, we want to start walking, you know. Done. When you walk, just walk. There's lots of teachings like this. The Zen tradition is filled with them. The Zen masters are all over this, you know. When you're chopping wood, just chop wood or whatever the hell it is. Because, O Brahman, I have now left behind all accepting and rejecting, all joys and sorrows, so it is that I now stay within myself. Acting out of ignorance is the same as desisting from action out of ignorance. So it's not a matter of acting or not acting. It's a matter of ignorance. So if you wise up, then you act properly. And when you wise up, then you don't act if you don't want to. See, but it's the wisdom that matters, not the action. It's not the action. And that's worth repeating over and over again. There is no Indian text that I'm aware of in the Hindu, Buddhist, or yogic traditions that say that you can work your way into freedom or enlightenment. That you can do something that will cause enlightenment or nirvana or freedom or liberation. No one is saying that. I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know everything by a long shot. So it... Huh? Correct. But that's not an action. That's an end of action, right? Yeah. Karma's the problem, not the solution. Karma's the problem. And the solution is wisdom. Always. The solution is not act or don't act. You know, act this way or not, or don't act this way. The solution is to act wisely. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says pretty clearly, you're always going to be acting. How could you not act? You say, what would that even mean to stop all possible thoughts in the mind, to stop all movements in the mind, to stop, you know, your body from, your heart from pumping, your breath from moving in and out? How would you not act? How could you not act? And furthermore, it wouldn't be desirable anyway. Krishna tells Arjuna, I act, I'm God. He's God, by the way. I act. If I didn't act, the whole cosmos would come to a screeching halt. But act in the proper way. Act without desire. Act without sankalpa. Sankalpa. Cindy was talking about this earlier, I think. Use that term. Sankalpa means intention. And there are plenty of practices that, you know, kind of as we move up the ladder of spiritual practices that are all about intention. You know, to have, set your intention and try to meet your intention. Have good intentions, not bad intentions. But when you get to the top rungs of the ladder, they say, don't have any intention at all. Okay, don't have intention. Act for its own sake, without what you think you're going to get out of it, without what you intend to get out of it. But just act because it's there to do. Knowing this to be really the way things are, so it is that I now stay within myself, trying to conceptualize what cannot be conceptualized, trying to chintya what is achintya. One is just stuck in conceptualizations. This is what I was trying to say at the beginning of the class. We are just stuck in our conceptualizations. We are not. As long as the mind is conceptualizing, we are not in touch with reality. You are in touch with conceptualization. So the thinking subject mind, the subject mind that's involved in words and language and doctrines and dogmas, in theories like the scientific mind is involved in, is not involved in reality. It's involved in conceptualization of reality. That's the only reality that we can access with words, is our own conceptualizations, not with the things and beings and events that are actually occurring. Trying to conceptualize what cannot be conceptualized. What cannot be conceptualized is reality. Tattva, as it is. See, not as we imagine it to be. Not as how we conceive of it to be, but as it is. Trying to conceptualize what cannot be conceptualized. One is just stuck in conceptualization. Abandoning such thinking, therefore, so it is that now I stay within myself. Stop making sense. Stop conceptualizing. Stop trying to work your will on the world through your thoughts, through your ideas, through your theories and isms and ologies. Someone who has accomplished this has really done something. He has fulfilled his purpose in life. Somebody who has gotten out of conceptual thought and had direct experience of reality. See, direct experience means non-conceptual. So some of you are trained in the Buddhist tradition, you heard the phrase many, many times, the direct perception of emptiness, right? That is not a conceptual state of mind. That's what the direct part is. It's when you stop conceiving of reality that you are gain the possibility of experiencing reality. Yeah. All right, we'll move on. You guys are getting tired. Me too. Oh, man. Even as a world renouncer, it is hard to obtain the contentment that comes from not owning anything. One of the commentaries that I read on this says, you know, like, even a world renouncer gets attached to their begging bowl and loincloth. You can get attached to anything, you know. So I just stay happy, leaving behind both renunciation and acquisition. See, without ego, who's acquiring or who's renouncing without the ego? Who's acquiring what? If there's no ego involved, there wouldn't be any attachment, there wouldn't be any acquisition, and there would be nothing to renounce either. Who would be renouncing if the ego's dropped? Realizing that truly there is nothing that is really ever done. When something arises that needs to be done, I just do it and just say, stay happy. I think Nike stole this from them. No, that phrase can take on a whole new meaning now. Just do it. Don't think about doing it. Don't think about what you're going to get out of it. Don't think about whether it's the right thing to do, the wrong thing to do. If it's there to do, do it. And there's going to be plenty for there to do, right? You know, tasks arise. You know, without a whole lot of like, oh, what should I do? You know, there's things that we obviously have to do in life. There's responsibilities that we have to fulfill. So he said, just do it. Stop thinking about the ego's thinking about action. The ego's thinking about action is always self-interested. What's in it for me? Is this going to benefit me or is it going to be a deficit? You see, always calculating. Like the businessman. Remember the last class, the businessman who is the ego. Yeah. So just do it. This is exactly the same teaching in the Bhagavad Gita. Exactly on karma yoga. On on how to act. It's not like, you know, renounce action. Of course we have to act. But act in a disinterested way. Act without sankalpa, without intention, without purpose, but because it's there to do. The practitioner of yoga who identifies with his body becomes obsessed with action and non-action. And by the way, the practitioner of yoga who identifies with his body is not a proper practitioner of yoga. Contra Yoga Journal. And all the other yoga pornography that's out there. It's not about identifying with your body. It's not about getting even more attached to your body than you already are. It's about quite the opposite, actually. It's about learning how to use your body as a kind of a vehicle, as a kind of a car, like driving a car or something like that. And the car is only rental. The practitioner of yoga who identifies with his body becomes obsessed with action and non-action. Focusing on the outside, right? You know, focusing on the body means you're also focusing on what should I do with my body? Should I move it or should I not move it or something like that? Abandoning both doing yoga and not doing yoga. I just stay happy. No, I mean, like, there's ways to, you know, to say, oh, I'm the kind of person that doesn't do yoga. That's just as bad as saying I'm the kind of person that does yoga. They're both ways of strengthening the ego. You see? Identifying the somebody self. Says, I do yoga, I don't do yoga, whatever. I have often observed that the appearance of pleasant things and events are out of my immediate control. Have you observed that? Also, aniyama. Aniyama is the Sanskrit word for it. You can't control it. So not caring about whether the thing or event is agreeable or disagreeable, I just stay happy. See, why honk your horn in gridlock, to coin a phrase? If you can't do anything about it, you know, why be anything other than just happy and content? Can you change the present in the present? Put that in your pipe and smoke it also. Can't change the present in the present. Can't just work your will on the world and change events, you know, at your will as they are happening. Change other people. How's that worked out so far? Trying to change other people. So he's saying, I've often observed that what happens in the moment isn't in my control. And he doesn't mention this, but there should be a little footnote here. And nor would I want it to be. How boring would that be in life? To be able to actually micromanage everything to your will. First of all, you'd screw it up. You know. And then second of all, it would just be boring to be able to, like, to be a, you know, we have this kind of fantasy. This is almost like superhero fantasy. Like the ultimate Batman. Who can just, you know, change things according to your will in the world. So, give that up. And then you can relax. See? You just stay happy. No matter what happens. If you can't change it, why worry about it? Does it change because, does it help because you're worried about what you can't change? Does that help in any way at all? It just makes you worse. Just makes it worse. So relax. Stay, yatasukam. Just stay happy all the time. So this is another kind of verse on acceptance, right? Acceptance of what you can't change. And what you can't change is the events as they occur moment to moment in the ongoing present. Can't change them. Distaste for the objects of the senses is freedom. Distaste for, you know, the ignorant understanding of sense objects. Back to the sense objects again. Having a taste for sensual pleasure is bondage. Such is wisdom. Do what you want with it, he says. I told you, you know, now do what you want with it. This awareness of reality makes one who is talkative, clever, and busy into someone silent, stupefied, and inactive. Beautiful, beautiful verse here. Talkative, clever, and busy are skills that you need for worldly success, aren't they? Knowing how to talk good, or I endeavor-minded, busy all the time, as opposed to the three that he says here. These are the three sort of characteristics of someone who is in awe, awestruck, silent, stupefied, and inactive, kind of frozen in awe. That's why it's shunned by those who just want to mindlessly live it up. That's why it... Really? I forgot what... I never can do that. I can never remember what I said 30 seconds ago. Oh, silent... Talk good again. I'm talking to talk gooder. Someone silent, stupefied, and inactive is someone in awe. Someone who has left curiosity and adopted wonder. You know, curiosity is always about the intellect. How do things work? Why do things happen? And so forth. Wonder is this silent, awestruck state of just, you know, being in awe of life itself and everything in it. Ignorant, liking and disliking, raga and devesha, are states of mind. And you have never been the mind. You are not what is going on in your mind. You are the condition of possibility for all mental phenomena, which is the difference from being the mental phenomena. So especially he's saying here, you are not your mental afflictions. That's not who you really are. And do we ever identify with our mental afflictions, do you think? Listen to the language. I am angry. I am sad. I am, you know, jealous. I am proud. We fully identify with them. And then we give them all kinds of power. You know, they're just phenomena, just mental phenomena, rising, they last for a while, and they dissipate. Like, you know, again, the change thing. If you watch them, if you just watch them without empowering them, they just pass, like clouds passing through the sky. But when we empower them by identifying with them, well, then they can really get some legs then. They can get some, like, longevity and a lot of, like, energy behind it, because we invest them with the energy by identifying with them. Ignorant, liking, and disliking are states of mind. You have never been the mind. You are awareness itself, unwavering and changeless. So go happy. Now he's got like, he's tired of saying sukhi bhava, so he says sukham chara. He's like, move around happily. See yourself in all beings and all beings as being you. Almost exactly a verse like this in the Bhagavad Gita. See all beings, see yourself in all beings. Sarva bhuteshu cha atmanam. Sarva bhutani cha atmani. And then see all beings as being you. Without a sense of me or mine, be happy. So this is identifying with everyone. See everyone as you. Radical re-identification, right? Dropping the somebody self, adopting the nobody self, so that there is space for the identification with everybody. You are no doubt consciousness itself, where everything is occurring, like waves arising from the sea. Uses that metaphor again.
Surf's
up. Sorry?
Surf's up.
Surf's up. You should wait until the end for that kind of stuff. So don't worry, Vitsvaro Bhava. Whatever you see, it's just you who is appearing. How could gold be different from the bracelets, armlets, and anklets made of it? I've heard this same kind of image used by Dzogchen teachers. That all of it's just like different shapes of the same stuff. That everybody and everything is just different ways of, you know, kind of molding the same material. Give up such distinctions as, I am so-and-so, but not such-and-such. See, that's individualism. Drop that individualism. Realize that you are everything. Sarva Atman. That your Atman is Sarva, is everything. Be purposeless. Ni sankalpa. The very word. Don't have a sankalpa. And then he says, sukhi bhava. Just be happy. Nothing that needs to be done. Be purposeless. Nothing that needs to be done. You may recite or listen to various scriptures, the shastras, over and over again. But unless you forget them all, you will not be independent. Yeah. Unlearning. Unlearning. So, you know, we learn all of this stuff about, you know, about a spiritual tradition, about a religion, and then we attach to it. And it brings us great pride to be able to recite the five of this and the ten of that and, you know, all of that. Just feeding the ego. Unlearn it. Drop it. Of course, you have to have it to drop it. So there's the kind of key. You know, you can't drop something that you haven't learned. You can't unlearn something that you haven't learned. So these are two different kind of stages on the path. First you learn. First you discipline. First you acquire, you know, a proper spiritual path. But then you also have to be willing to let it go too, if you're going to achieve the highest goals of freedom. So, you know, you can imagine how this must have sounded in ancient India. You know, reciting the scriptures was what they were all about. You can still go and see it. You can still go see Brahmins who can recite the Vedas from, like, you know, beginning to end, every single syllable by heart, they know. They play games like this. They say, you know, instead of reciting, you know, the verse A, B, C, D, I'll recite it A, D, B, C. Then I'll recite it A, C, B, D. Then I'll recite it D, A. You know, every possible permutation. They spend their whole lives, you know, like, learning these things by heart. Says, just forget it. Ashtavaka says, just forget all that, you know. Unlearn it. Unless you forget them all, you will not be independent. O wise one, you may strive for enjoyment, bhoga, or to amass good karma, or to perfect meditation, samadhi, but your mind will still long for that which is beyond all goals, where all desires have been eliminated. So you can have all kinds of desires for enjoyment. You can have desires for good karma, you know, be a good person and have good experiences in life. Or to have desire to perfect meditation, but they're all just desires. And then he says, your mind will still long for that which is beyond all goals. The desire for the end of desire. The goal for the end of having goals, you see. Where all desires have been eliminated. What we really desire is desireless. And I urge you to think about that. Desire rules us. We're driven by desire. But what is it that's behind all desire? What is it that you really want? Is it almost as big a question as who are you? Is what do you want? You know, that'd be a good question to ask, you know, if you had one question like Janaka has one question of Ashtavaka. What should I want? You know, that'd be a good one question. I had somebody ask me this one time. If you met the Dalai Lama like face to face, what would you say to him? And you know, you probably want to ask a question since you got, you know, the opportunity with the Dalai Lama. But then what would the question be exactly? You know, have to be something. I, if you were going to really maximize, get your big bang for your buck here, you'd probably want to say something like, "Well, how should I live?" It's the same kind of question that these guys always. And what should I want is a pretty good question. What should I desire? What should I be striving for? And, Ashtavaka would probably say, strive for the end of striving. Make efforts to achieve the goal of not making effort. Of not, desire strongly the end of desire. So how else are we going to get to the end of desire unless we desire it? But it's got to also, the desire for the end of desire has to end also for there to be an end of desire. So it's a little bit puzzling. I used to teach in the academic world, I used to teach, introduction to Indian religions, and a lot of them say the problem is desire. Always some smart kid in the back would raise their hand and so would say, well, you know, how could I reach the end of desire unless I desired it? It's a pretty good question. But the answer is also quite clear. It's the last one to go. You desire the end of desire. You know, you desire, desire, desire. You know, and until you're ready to end desire, and then you don't desire the end of desire because you've ended desire. You see. Which one are we on? Everyone is unhappy because they are always exerting themselves. Everyone's unhappy because they're always working, always trying to get something that they don't have, become somebody that they're not, etc. Everyone is unhappy because they're always exerting themselves, and no one knows this. With this teaching, a fortunate one obtains emancipation, nirvritti. Then one of my favorite verses, happiness belongs to the master of laziness. Durina means leader or master, alasya, the master of laziness, for whom even the chore of opening and shutting the eyes is tired. And the example he uses there is very apt. If we had to be conscious about opening and shutting our eyes, if we had to make effort to keep our eyes opening and shutting, that would be exhausting. If we had to make effort to breathe in and then breathe out, that would be so tiring. If we had to make effort to keep our heart beating, to keep our blood flowing, you see, there's all kinds of things that we're doing without effort. All kinds of it. And so he says, live a whole life like that. Live your whole life like that. I've been using, on tour, the example of driving the car. I think most experienced drivers are able to drive the car mindfully, but unselfconsciously. If you were self-conscious, you know, if you had to make efforts all the time to drive the car, you have to pull over every couple of blocks and just rest. Not because it would be like so tiring. All of the little moves that you have to make with the steering wheel and the accelerator and the brake and all like that. If you have to think about all of that all the time. So he's saying, well, you know, that's why you're so exhausted in life. That's why you're so stressed out. That's why you're so anxious. That's why life is suffering, is because you're thinking, have to think about it all the time. Making efforts, you know, exerting yourself. So be the master of laziness. All right. So last page here. As long as desire, the seat of the inability to discriminate. So desire here means the judging that comes with desire, rather than discrimination. The judging that comes with desire is this is better than that. All right, always. I desire it because it's better than something else. Discrimination means it's different. Right? Discriminate. So, as long as desire, the seat of the inability to discriminate, is alive, there will be avoidance and attraction, which are the root and branch of samsara. Desire comes from activity and aversion from abstention. The wise person, like a child, balavat, like a child, is free from such dualities and is stable. This is not the only text that says it would be a good thing to be childlike. Not in the sense of like naive or, you know, or anything like that, but simple, unlearned, unlearned, you know, simple, just enjoying life as it comes without preferences. A passionate person wants to escape samsara out of a desire to avoid suffering. But one who is free of passion is also free of suffering and is not bothered even in samsara. So one way to understand this is that the acceptance of samsara is nirvana. The radical acceptance of samsara as it is nirvana. One who feels pride, abhimana, about his moksha, about his so-called liberation. It kind of says that. Moksha api. Api means like, kind of like that. One who feels pride about his so-called liberation, or who feels possessive about his body, is neither a wise man nor a yogi. So he's got like both the Dharma practitioners and the yoga practitioners covered here. Those who feel proud about like how advanced they are, how much realizations they have, or something like that, Or those who feel like they're so awesome because they can do like exotic, you know, physical poses. They're neither a wise man nor a yogi. He's just another suffering being. Just another attached suffering being. Even if your teacher is Shiva or Vishnu or Brahma, these are the big three in Hinduism. Hara, Hari, and Brahma. Even if your teacher is like that, you cannot become independent until you have forgotten everything. Sarva Vismarana. Forgotten all that you learned from even teachers as big as the, you know, the three big gods. As long as you are grasping to the teachings, grasping to the scriptures, grasping even to the gurus, you will not be free. So this is one of those radical kind of verses here, you know, that's directed towards advanced spiritual practitioners. You've got to let go of even that. You've got to let, and forget it. Forget everything that you learned. Unlearn it. Which also presupposes that you learned it, of course. Have to learn it to forget it. Can't forget it if there's nothing to forget. But you can't be grasping onto it either. It's just another form of conceptual thinking that's preventing us from direct experience. All right, so I went on a little long tonight, I'm sorry. The exercise for class 3 is on the next page. There's a lot of talk about the nature of suffering and its opposite, you know, liberation in these readings, and about craving. So the exercise is to practice radical acceptance and contentment. And we can't achieve contentment unless we practice it. So it takes some practice. Just sit and accept whatever's happening in your life for 15 minutes a day. I mean, that's probably enough. You'll have to go and rest for a while afterwards. Take a shower. Just saying yes to life. Just saying yes to your life. There's a book by Rajneesh Osho, a great book on Tantra, where he says that Tantra is the great yes saying to life. That's the essence of the esoteric practice of Tantra, is to just say yes to life in every dimension of it without wanting to change it or improve it or get rid of it, or, you know, but just to say yes. So, you know, if you wanted to do the shorthand version of the exercise, you could just practice saying yes for 15 minutes a day.